Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Coffey Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be reviewing a multitude of regulatory and compliance topics, including artificial intelligence, books and records, types of marketing materials, the SEC marketing rule, post-commitment management fees, private fund recycling, and many more fantastic issues in our first ever compliance grab bag. To help guide us through this conversation, we welcome in Christine Schleppergrell from Morgan Lewis and Christopher Mulligan from Weil Gotshal. In our headline section, we review the first Advisors Act enforcement action under the new administration and what it tells us about future actions. And we close up today with another installment of What's on My Mind, where a recent statement from Commissioner Peirce provides us deep insight into the future state of crypto and digital currencies and the road ahead. Moving into our headline section, on February 15, 2025, the SEC settled an administrative proceeding with a retail investment advisor for violating multiple sections of the Advisors Act. This case is particularly significant as it really marks the first Investment Advisors Act enforcement action under the new administration, providing us insight into the potential regulatory and enforcement priorities for the next 4 years. What happened here? Well, among the allegations, the investment advisor and one of its representatives violated their fiduciary duty by improperly converting more than 180 brokerage accounts, which were primarily low activity accounts with minimal amounts of trading activity, into investment advisory accounts. These accounts belong to retail investors, including some elderly clients. And as a result of these improper conversions, the investment advisor generated an additional $268,000 in revenue, with 75% of that being retained by the investment advisor representative involved. One of the things that's interesting about this case is that it is reminiscent of many of the enforcement cases brought under the Clayton administration, signaling that the new administration will maintain a strong focus on enforcement, but may shift the nature of the types of cases it pursues. This case stands apart from enforcement actions brought under the Gensler-led SEC in several different ways. Number one, there's definitely a focus here on retail investors, right? So the victims here are sympathetic retail investors, including elderly individuals, clearly making investor protection a top priority. This is different from Gensler era cases that were often focused on large Wall Street investment managers. In addition, we charged individuals here. So both the investment advisor and the representative involved in the misconduct were charged, whereas Gensler era cases often focused on firms rather than individuals. There was also a clear fraud component here. So unlike some Gensler era cases where there was no obvious fraud, this case clearly involved deception, which resulted in direct financial harm to investors. And finally, there seemed to be a bit of a simplistic or straightforward nature with regard to the case, where it involves clear misconduct without the complexity often seen in some of those more institutional investor style cases. What is similar about these cases that is consistent with a Gensler Commission practice? Certainly there's an emphasis on policies and procedures here, right? So similar to Gensler era cases, this enforcement action underscores the importance of adhering to written internal compliance policies and procedures and ensuring that firms follow their own rules with regard to its compliance program. In this particular case, the advisor's written compliance policies required obtaining fully completed investment management agreements before charging advisory fees. And in addition, the policies mandated periodic reviews of fee schedules and accuracy testing of client fees. However, in this case, as you might expect, the representative failed to provide fee schedules for many of those converted accounts and submitted incomplete schedules for several others. Also consistent with Gensler era practices is using the negligence standard in fiduciary duty, right? So the SEC pursued this case based on a negligence standard rather than requiring proof of intent. The order also referenced the firm's fiduciary duty violations when describing the misconduct. And these points seem to indicate that the enforcement cases can proceed without needing to meet a significantly higher standard of proof. Finally, As you can see here, technical violations are still very, very much in focus. The inclusion of Rule 2043 as a charge, even though it was certainly more secondary to some of the more serious violations and deceptive activity, suggests that the SEC is going to continue to pursue cases involving technical regulatory infractions here, such as delivery of the disclosure documents in form ADD. I'd like to offer a shout out to Igor Rosenblatt and Iron Road Partners for providing much of the source information and additional analysis regarding this particular case. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be doing a first ever episode on the Compliance and Context podcast, and that is Compliance Grab Bag today on the Compliance and Context podcast. We're going to be covering all different types of subject matter areas, but really those that we've seen significantly impact the area of examinations. And to help guide us through a lot of these fantastic topics and share with us their wonderful insights, very pleased to be welcoming in for the first time Christine Schleppergrell, who is going to be joining us from Morgan Lewis. And some of you may remember our great friend and podcast, former podcast guest, Chris Mulligan, who's also going to be joining us from Wiles Private Funds Practice. Christine Schleppergrell counsels asset managers on legal, regulatory, and compliance matters, focusing on advisors to private funds, private equity, hedge, VC, infrastructure, real estate, et cetera, and separately managed accounts. She spent several years in private practice and more recently at the SEC, including in leadership roles in the Division of Investment Management. While at the SEC, Christine led the private funds branch during a time of landmark rulemaking impacting private fund advisors, something we'll be very excited to tap into today. And she continues to draw on this experience to help advise on current and pending regulations and to guide clients through enforcement and examinations proceedings. Christopher Mulligan is a partner in Wiles Private Funds Practice and is based in D.C. Chris acts as outside regulatory counsel to asset managers, providing counsel regarding SEC examinations and investigations, Advisors Act compliance, fund formation issues, and strategic advice. Similar to Christine, prior to Weil in 2024, Chris had spent a long time at the SEC, where he served most recently as an investment advisor, private funds senior advisor, and co-coordinator of the agency's private funds specialized working group. He's also a very active public speaker. Chris and Christine, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Very excited to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Patrick. Great to be back.
So as we alluded to at the top, and I've got to give Christine a little bit of credit here, because she was the one that came up with the concept of the compliance grab bag. Because part of the thing that we were bumping into, even as we were talking about doing a show together, is there's so much we could talk about right now. There's a lot happening out there in the space and a lot of, I think, really important topics for legal practitioners and compliance officers in this space. And so we thought, let's do a compliance grab bag. We'll talk about a host of different regulatory compliance issues and maybe do a little bit deeper dive into some of the things we're seeing on the examination front, specifically as it relates to private fund advisors. So as we look to kick things off, I think certainly one topic that has frequently been on the top of many people's minds, at the top of many people's minds over the last couple of years, and that is namely AI, artificial intelligence, and how it's being used. And so maybe, Christine, maybe we'll start with you. I would love to talk a little bit about what you're seeing kind of as it relates to AI, and specifically what you're seeing on, I know there's a lot of different products out there, but certainly we see like Microsoft Copilot and others, and maybe we can start to dive into some of the issues we're seeing coming up during examinations.
Absolutely. So I think one thing we're getting a lot of questions from our registered advisors is use of AI, including Microsoft Copilot and other tools for note-taking, other ways of making and streamlining the operational parts of being a registered advisor more efficient. And there's also, of course, the external use of AI. So use of AI for investment purposes, to make investment decisions, And kind of thinking about the internal and external use cases for AI and what that means when used in the Advisors Act framework, especially from a books and records perspective, I think is one that's really come to the forefront. Lots of questions about, can we use an external note-taking tool? What does that mean for my books and records obligations when I get examined?
Yeah, that's great. Great. Chris, anything to add on onto that?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of interpretive issues with record keeping that's done by AI, right? Is that a document that's written by the advisor? You know, what sort of actions are you supposed to take, compliance actions you're supposed to take that would protect you against an enforcement action? And I think we're sort of at a place now where two things are true, but they're both very important. One is we hope, you know, I think the industry hopes these sort of mass enforcement actions on off-channel communications, that is ceased for some period of time, that is everyone's hope, and that we may seek some guidance on these issues from the policy divisions within the SEC in terms of how you are supposed to think about books and records, how are you supposed to think about these products that are being used widely among investment advisors, and that there'll be, you know, sort of proactive guidance instead of after the fact enforcement on a lot of these really difficult issues. So that is true. We're hopeful that is true, and we're pretty comfortable with that. The other point that is also true is that if you look through these enforcement actions, a lot of the activity happened in 2019, 2020, right? Investigations look back. And so, you know, there's folks in the industry that say, you know, do we have to worry about this at all anymore? And the reality is we don't, even if we have some sense of where the commission is headed on these issues for the next few years, 2029 is not that far away, right? And there may be a new commission and they may have new ideas about these issues. And so while I think it's important that we try to seek guidance on off-channel communication, we're hopeful the sort of mass enforcement actions will cease. It's also important to still deal with these issues, still have a process in place, still continue grappling with them, because it's actually the conduct that's going to happen in the next year or two by a future commission, not this one.
Yeah, I think that's really a really important point to add. Christine, were you going to add something onto that as well?
I was just going to say, I completely agree with Chris, and that's something to keep in mind as we move through all of these topics today and think about, well, what does the change in administration mean for the compliance world for investment advisors? And to Chris's point, because that look back spans longer than 3 to 4 years, we really have to be mindful of, are we taking an appropriate course of action? And then, of course, balancing that with making good business decisions.
Yeah. And this is definitely an area, I mean, of the questions I've received during annual compliance trainings, other kinds of things, people are looking at resources for the upcoming year. This is probably the most pressing question I'm getting from a lot of advisors on what to do and if they're okay to launch this new application or to start this new initiative and how they're going to approach it. And I see very different bands as far as what their interpretation of something as an official book and record that needs to be kept versus something similar, more akin to like a notepad or to like a temporary file that you would have within the other Microsoft suite of applications like Word and Excel, but that would automatically go away within a certain period of time. And to your point, I mean, yes, we are at the beginning of a new administration. You know, Paul Atkins likely to be taking over here soon. But you're absolutely right that we can't just plan for the now when we're setting these kinds of things up. We have to be cognizant of what that's going to mean from a long-term impact into the future, including should there be another shift in an administration 4 years from now. Let's stay on that topic. And, you know, one thing I guess I would say that seems to be also related to AI, but I would also say I would equate this to be more in line with just like an advisor's duty more broadly to represent itself accurately, which is we've seen firms talking about how it's using AI in its advisory services. And so this is both an AI issue, but also starting to dovetail a little bit into the marketing area. And so, you know, I think, you know, Chris, you actually in particular are a wonderful person to talk on this. So maybe I'll have you kick it off because you've talked a little bit about this on some of our prior episodes. But, you know, what representations does a firm need to make sure it's providing anytime it's discussing AI and the use of its advisory services. And are there, you know, to a little bit of what Christine was just referencing, thinking about how firms might be using AI internally, is there an obligation on a firm to disclose their use of AI for other, I'll call it more compliance or operational type, you know, purposes?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a temptation. So there's temptations on both sides, on the exam side and on the registrant side here, right? So investment advisors, obviously AI is a huge force in the economy, in investing, and people want to talk about it. And that's fine in terms of talking about, you know, how this is going to impact markets, how this is going to impact due diligence processes generally, right? There's you sort of can't live today and not talk about AI. That's fine. The problem is it's easy to fall into the representation of how you either use it, how you look for portfolio companies that use it, how it's part of your management process, right? So it goes from sort of a high level discussion of AI in our sort of, you know, in sort of our culture and our society, and it goes into specific representations about how you are using. Okay, we've talked a lot about the market rule in the past. That trips up substantiation. That trips up 20648. On the exam side, right? They now have this tool, substantiation, under the marketing rule that they can use, and it's almost unlimited in terms of what topics they can look at. AI is also of interest to examiners. Because they know it's of interest to investors. So those representations, look, by rule, there's nothing different about a representation about AI than a representation about, you know, your biography or your office location or anything else, right? It's all, you know, they're all statements of material fact, but it is going to draw the interest of examiners for the same reason you're interested in talking about it, right? It's a hot issue. You know, examiners know that it's of interest to investors. And so I would say those statements that you're making about how you use AI, how you incorporate it into your investment thesis, they are really, really important to think about exactly what you're saying and what you have to substantiate.
Yeah, that's great. Christine, anything to add to that?
Sure. And I think also sort of the other side of the coin is the use of AI for non-investment purposes. So think compliance, operational purposes, to the point that you made earlier, just assessing staffing needs and how those can be addressed, and AI can be a huge time saver. So we're looking at firms that are considering whether they should disclose, for example, in their form ADV, the use of artificial intelligence, even if it is for that internal use case only that we talked about at the top of our podcast. And should they disclose that and say, look, we use AI for certain internal compliance functions.
And also,
firms may be asking, do we use AI? Do we need to disclose our use of AI for internal compliance purposes? But we've also seen firms dig even deeper and say, well, we're also going to disclose the fact that we may hire some third parties and those third parties may use AI. We have no control over that. We don't know about that. And so that's where I've seen the depth of disclosure on AI go pretty far. I think we've come a long way in the sense of disclosing away what types of AI is being used and who's using it.
Yeah. No, that's really helpful context, Christine, and definitely would say we have come a long way. Although, you know, and I'm sure you all are seeing a very wide spectrum of how people are using it, and I think some are using it really effectively, but definitely a wide spectrum, especially as people continue to use AI to create other types of marketing and other types of podcasts and even to review marketing materials or assist with a compliance review of marketing materials. You know, as you are seeing firms start to do that or use AI for those purposes, any best practices or maybe thoughts or tips, considerations that you might give firms that are looking to use AI to perform some of those, you know, different activities? Maybe Christine, I'll stay with you on this one.
Sure. I think one thing to think about, if we're talking about just the use of AI, for example, to create podcasts. So we have to make this podcast better than an AI produced podcast. That is our goal today. We must make that happen. But all of those things, I think we need to think about, how would this be viewed by the SEC exam staff through the lens of the general prohibitions, right? We're not talking about performance, or we're not talking about any of those types of things that would be covered by other parts of the marketing rule, but just, would this be misleading? And do we need to disclose to potential investors that AI was a part of creating this marketing material? That's something that many advisors are considering.
Mm-hmm. That makes complete sense to me, in the same way that if content has been created by some other third party that then you are going to use in your marketing very frequently, a disclosure that you will see is at least a source nod, footnote disclosure, or something to that effect, indicating where the content was actually created versus the advisor it being a unique creation on their own part. Chris, anything to add on to what Christine mentioned?
I think what I would say is, remember that, you know, your fiduciary duty attaches to you no matter what, right? So if you're using AI to perform due diligence on an underlying portfolio company, you have to have a process to make sure the AI is delivering accurate results, right? You can't outsource your fiduciary duty to an AI system. And so it's really, really important to make sure that you understand what the AI is doing, what it's not doing, what its limitations are, and that you have a testing process in place to do that. It's the same as any third-party service provider, but I think there can be, you know, as you know, high school students outsource their papers to AI systems, there could be a sort of tendency to say, you know, well, AI did this and we're using this. You have to stay on top of it. And you have to, not only you have to stay on top of it, you have to be able to demonstrate to exam staff that you're staying on top of it.
Yeah, that's actually, man, that is like a perfect segue. I didn't even tee you up for that. But as I'm thinking about this getting back to basics idea, which is exactly what you're describing, and I think about some of the recent stuff that we've seen, whether it's some of the guidance from the risk alerts that have come out over the past, you know, 2 years, 3 years on the marketing rule, but also just some other things that people have been highlighting anecdotally in examinations they have on the marketing rule. I think one of the things that I continue to hear is people wanting to get back to basics about, like, what is an advertisement, you know, like, and making sure that when they're identifying the right things that they need to make sure that they're reviewing and adding in the right disclosures, that being able to interpret correctly, again, this very fundamental thing is super important. Chris, maybe if I'll kind of stay on you here, talk to us a little bit about, you know, again, from an SEC marketing rule perspective and some of the things that you're hearing, other regulatory compliance issues, you know, talk to us a little about, again, what is an advertisement, and maybe some other things that you might be seeing in the space that are worth mentioning.
Yeah, I think there's always, in most exams, there's sort of an initial question and the sort of initial battle lines drawn in terms of, like, what is an ad? What is brand awareness, right? What is a white paper versus what is a one-on-one communication, right? So there's a lot of exceptions to advertisements. Who is the target of the advertisement? Is it underlying portfolio companies that you're trying to purchase, or is it the investors in the fund? And it's just incredibly, you are in such a better position if you put the thought into exactly what it is before you create it and disseminate it, right? It's always more challenging once you're challenged and you by an examiner and you didn't sort of preemptively think about what it was, to sort of go back and try to recreate the timeline and exactly why it was created and who the audience was. If as you're creating it, you're like, this is brand awareness, well, there's certain things that probably shouldn't be included, right? You probably should not have performance, for example, in something that is about brand awareness or like a charity event or something like that. You know, if it's one-on-one communication, obviously it has to be tailored. It has to be, you know, not something that you dupe and just send in, you know, a lot of like one-on-one communications that aren't legitimate, right? So you have to put in thought and like what does that mean, and what level of customization do I need to make it a legitimate one-on-one communication? You know, if the target audience is portfolio companies instead of the investors, we should make that clear, both in terms of the substance and in terms of your internal view of it. So, you know, you, when you're creating anything that you're going to disseminate outside of your firm, it's really important to put it in the right category And then make sure that it it's defensible in terms of you're thinking about it, why this is relevant to an audience. And you have to be really careful with performance, right? Anytime you have investor performance or anything that's really about what an investor experiences, that's going to make the brand awareness argument, you know, more challenging. It's going to make, you know, it's going to make, you know, the portfolio company argument more challenging, right? So you just want to be really thoughtful in terms of what information you put in there and try to make sure that it's customized to the audience. And that way you have the strongest possible argument when exams comes in and asks you, what is an ad and what is it not? And why did you make this determination?
I think that's really smart. I think you mentioned a couple of things in there that are really important to continue to reiterate. But before maybe discussing a couple of those, I would love to hear, Christine, I'd love to get your thoughts. Anything in there that Chris said that you would certainly echo, and maybe any other things that you'd like to highlight kind of from an SEC marketing rule perspective, some different regulatory and compliance issues that you're seeing?
Absolutely. I do want to hit on one thing Chris mentioned about websites of advisors that are really intended for portfolio companies. So to attract portfolio companies. And I think that is something that is a nuance that I agree with Chris. If an advisor has a framework that is set up in advance and it says, look, we have all of these types of communications. Some of them are advertisements subject to the marketing rule. Some of them are not, because their purpose is X, Y, and Z. It's not an offer of securities related advisory services. Rather, we are trying to attract portfolio companies that might be interested in receiving an investment from our fund. That is a different use case. And so I think having that framework document, and we've helped advisors set this up just so that they can better bucket their communications and say, these are ads, these are not, here's why. And it's very helpful to your point, Patrick, because as they move forward in their journey of creating new communications using AI, maybe to create those communications, it makes it easier if they have that framework in place and they said, okay, well, this looks like the other communications. It's not an advertisement because X, Y, and Z. And so it's a very easy filtering mechanism to use. So just wanted to amplify that point because I think it's a really good one. And then one thing to add, I know as we're talking about back to basics, one thing that I keep going back to and keep getting the question is, what is hypothetical performance? So I think that, in addition to what is an advertisement, are two of the really big picture questions that keep coming up, even though we've been living with this rule for some time now. But those two concepts, because they are broadly defined, especially hypothetical performance, I think really trips people up.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great call out. Chris, I'd be interested to hear if you have any of that. I know I certainly get that a lot, especially from private fund advisors that are going into a capital raise, potentially from the first time, maybe since before even the marketing rule compliance date of November 2022, potentially there are other folks that are coming back in now who maybe didn't have at the time as robust internal controls or sophisticated measures from a compliance and marketing perspective. Now they're coming back into a fundraise and they're like, wait a minute, target performance is hypothetical performance? There's a little bit of education that goes on there. But, you know, Chris, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Patrick, that even though the marketing rule isn't that new, particularly in the closed end space, it's still new for a relatively large number of advisors because they are now fundraising the first time since the marketing rule was implemented. So there's still a lot of learning curve about the new rule. And I think that hypothetical performance could be a very challenging subject because if you obviously it picks up targets, it picks up past models, it picks up hopes and dreams, right? It picks up a lot of different things. It also picks up things that people don't think of as hypothetical, like when you create a sort of new fund by teasing out multiple investments from other funds to kind of create a fictional fund. Well, each one of those portfolio companies, like that did happen, right? And the performance was there and you're sort of combining it in a fictional fund, but because no investor experienced it, it's likely to be hypothetical performance. It kicks in all the requirements. So it's a broad, it picks up a lot of information that folks don't necessarily think of as hypothetical performance. And I think the one thing that I think you can take comfort from is the requirements are not that challenging in terms of you know, having policies and procedures that connect them to your intended audience, which is quite easy for private fund investors because they're sophisticated and so forth. So, but you have to actually make that connection, right? So you actually have to key it into your policies and procedures. And then, you know, assumptions about, you know, the limitations and risks and assumptions you made and including it, you know, those are not terribly challenging, or frankly are assumptions that probably should have been in there prior to the marketing rule. So I think determining whether something is hypothetical can be very challenging. And there's a lot of brain power that kind of goes into that. But the consequence of it being hypothetical performance isn't that severe. But getting to that point can be really challenging.
Yeah, no, I think, one, appreciate all of that context from you both as it relates to hypothetical performance, because I think that's really valuable for a lot of our listeners that are likely still struggling with that. And I'll even, you know, stay on maybe a couple other issues also tied a little bit to performance, just to see if you have any other additional thoughts. You know, on the model fees front, I'd be interested to hear how you might see firms approaching that issue. And also, what about kind of, you know, predecessor performance? Are you seeing any issues there? Maybe, I forget who we went to last time, but maybe Christine, I'll start with you this time, and Chris will come back to you.
Sure. So on the model fee front, we're still seeing folks struggle, understandably, with some of the language in the adopting release versus what is in the rule text. And just it's not always completely streamlined and clear. So this could be one area where we might be able to get some guidance from the SEC staff on how to interpret the model fee provisions in the adopting release versus what is in the rule text. So I think that's something we might be able to look forward to. I think in the meantime, folks are really focusing on who's the intended audience and what is the best way to express to them the fees that they will actually experience, but then also make sure we don't run afoul of the performance provisions and certainly not the general prohibition. So in some cases, we're seeing just a lot of over-disclosure, we could call it, in terms of satisfying those model fee provisions.
Mr. Mulligan, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of certain words that just make, you know, people who practice in this area like have nightmares. And one of them is footnote 590, which is in the release, which talks about if the fee to be charged to the intended audience is anticipated to be higher than the actual fees charged, the advisor must use a model fee that reflects the anticipated fee to be charged in order not to violate the rule's general prohibitions. Those are very scary words for a very small subset of people that practice in this space. But what it means is real performance sometimes isn't enough. You actually have to sort of imagine, come up with a hypothetical fee, model fee, to match the intended audience of the new product, which sort of sounds easy. But the problem is the fee and expense structures are very complicated for a lot of private fund advisors. And it is tremendously difficult to deal with that. I mean, my experience with examiners is there is some common sense here in terms of you're not going to know every conceivable fee and expense, but it's still incredibly difficult to kind of go through that exercise and understand exactly what is going to be charged to the new audience, what was or was not charged in the existing fund. And, you know, this is a place where maybe we can, you know, I'm hopeful that we can get some guidance around this area because it's very, very difficult. Predecessor performance, you mentioned, has, you know, really a lot of challenges. It can be very, very difficult to comply with a lot of the requirements and predecessor performance. It is another area where I think it would be great to have some guidance from SEC staff.
Yeah, and I guess even staying on that point, because I think there are also a couple other areas where getting a little bit more guidance from the staff would be really, really helpful. I know some of these are a little, I'm trying to think of the right, like they're not as much science. There might be a little bit more art on a couple of these items. And so I know that I get a lot of questions from advisors in the marketing area asking questions like, do disclosures always have to be on the same page as the content that you're pushing out? And, you know, hey, I reread the rule, which, you know, a compliance professional or a legal person would be like, great, that's awesome. But then they say, what does fair and balanced mean? And what exactly do I need to do with that? And so maybe Chris, I'll start with you this time. You know, any thoughts on either of those questions or any other kind of challenging issues that, that you're hoping to get a little more guidance from on from the SEC?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are great questions. And I think, you know, frankly, the other thing that is interesting from the private sector point of view is how knowledgeable examiners are about the marketing rule, right? They really do understand this rule deeply, sort of across the board, basically across the entire examination program. And there's so many tools they can use, right? There's these very, very technical requirements, right? Like, and those you have to follow, right? You have to follow the net and gross, the sort of very clear cut rules. And sort of like a code of ethics type rule, right? With very strict requirements, which you don't have a lot of in the Advisors Act, but this part of the marketing rule has that element to it that makes them very dangerous on exams. But then you have another whole part of the rule, which is, as you say, these fair balance concepts, you know, what does clear and prominent mean? Like where exactly does this disclosure have to be? And with those, there's a lot of, you know, that's more like a compliance rule type of a rule where there's a lot of, or 204 cap A rule, where there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how examiners may or may not think about this issue. Well, I think examiners really understand the marketing rule. You know, reasonable minds can reach different conclusions in terms of what fair and balanced means and what clear and prominent means. And so there's a lot of sort of tools that examiners have with the marketing rule to examine advisors, and you don't know exactly where they're going to come from. You know, my advice is step one, make sure the easy stuff you comply with, right? Anything that's a very clear rule, don't mess that up. The others, it's just have a position that's reasonable. And that doesn't mean examiners aren't going to disagree with you. They may, and you can work with them to fix it in a way that satisfies them going forward. But I think the important thing is just to be thoughtful about what you are doing and why you think it's fair and balanced, and just be able to explain that and demonstrate that to examiners, because that's what makes this such an interesting rule. It's a mix of very hard and fast requirements, and requirements that are sort of tough to understand where a certain examiner may come out on it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Christine, anything to build on from what Chris said there?
Sure. I have a great answer to your question of do disclosures have to be on the same page? And the answer, the universal answer to that question is it depends on how many pages you have. If you have a 50-page pitch deck, then I do not think that the hypothetical performance, the mention of that, can make its first appearance on slide 49. So it's things like this where, to Chris's point, is it reasonable? Is this confusing to an investor? And if counsel is reviewing your pitch deck and they're having to have three screens open and having to blow up teeny tiny font in order to mark up your pitch deck for the marketing rule, this is a sign that it is probably not going to meet certain standards. If it is irritating for counsel to try and read your deck and mark it up, I think that's something to consider. You know, are we making this accessible to investors, or are we making this too difficult? And are we going to get flagged by the SEC because we're non-compliant? Even if we checked all the technical boxes of the rule, are we still running afoul of the general prohibitions? Is disclosure too far away, too small, too confusing, too much, in the wrong place? I think those are all sort of the softer things in the rule that you really have to feel out. And different counsel will have different views on that. And that's fine. But it's, to Chris's point, I think giving it some thought and thinking about how accessible is this information.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And I love the call out on the question around do disclosures have to be on the same page. I'll add two quick call outs before we move on to our next subject matter in the compliance grab bag today. But one of them is on third party ratings, which is, and I have used this example before, but as much as I would love for the Pat Hayes Power Index to be part of a third-party rating that you can use on your website, just let's vet some of the third-party ratings that we put on our websites and social media pages a little bit better than maybe has been done. And then another one that I think would be really nice for the SEC to provide a little bit of extra guidance on, but would also welcome your all's thoughts on it, would be in the area of solicitation agreements and what's happening there. Any thoughts or feedback on third-party ratings and or solicitation agreements? And maybe Christine, I'll kind of start with you there.
Absolutely. I think on third-party ratings, I'd encourage managers to take a look at their decks historically. And if their pitch deck is talking about third-party ratings from many years ago, maybe it's pre-marketing rule, that still needs to be brought up to speed. So just because it's an old third-party rating that occurred before the marketing rule doesn't mean that it is not subject to the rule. So I think we're seeing a lot of that where it's like, oh, we got this award in 2000, we're still showing it. Well, it still needs to be brought up to speed. On the point of solicitation agreements, I think that is going to be an area where the exam staff will probably dig in sometime soon. I haven't seen too much of that type of activity on exams. Maybe Chris, you have, but in terms of negotiating these agreements, I think that the experience varies significantly depending on whether you're talking to a big, powerful placement agent, a smaller shop, a placement agent that is outside of the United States. And depending on what exemptions they qualify for, I think managers are very concerned that they need to satisfy their reasonable basis belief. Meanwhile, the placement agent is taking the position, this rule doesn't apply to me. And so it's really a you problem, advisor, not a me problem as a placement agent. And so I think that is something where it's getting challenging for advisors to get the terms they need to form the reasonable basis belief that the placement agent is complying with a rule that doesn't apply to them. So it puts managers in a tricky situation, and the tools they have in their toolbox to deal with that are contractual provisions. And so that is something where negotiation plays a really big role.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, for so many years, the placement agents got used to the fact that, you know, that process was carved out of the old advertising rule and specifically exempted. And so, you know, I think Christine's right. I think, you know, major U.S. placement agents by this point have gotten the picture that you're going to negotiate a bunch of stuff in this this engagement letter that didn't used to be there. But with smaller placement agents, with non-U.S. placement agents, this is a pretty big shock. The sort of amount of reps they have to make about the materials they'll use, that they have to be pre-reviewed, that you have to make this disclosure every time you engage with investors. Like, this is not easy, and I think it's still taking time to kind of work its way through the placement agent system here. And it's made a lot of progress, I think, among major placement agents in the United States, but it's still a challenge with non-US placement agents and smaller ones.
Yeah. No, thank you both for that additional background. Again, I think that's really helpful, and certainly to help frame what are likely going to be some key considerations for folks that are going to be entering that space, or maybe looking for an upcoming fundraise, looking to engage placement agents in a similar capacity moving forward. As we move to the next topic of our compliance grab bag, I definitely think that I would put an exclamation point on this particular subject matter area, because I have seen during examinations that, obviously, look, the private fund advisor rules got vacated. Everybody's fully aware of that. That doesn't mean that many of the concepts that were in those private fund advisor rules have continued to kind of seep out and get played out during examinations of advisors that are managing private funds. And I certainly think some of that has come out on kind of the management fees side of the house and what firms are doing there. Maybe Chris, I'll start with you on this one. You know, what are you seeing from a fees and expenses standpoint in examinations, or just from questions from clients and some of the stuff that they're getting, and any other kind of regulatory and compliance issues that might be tied to them?
Sure. So these are some of the scariest words you can hear as a practitioner, as post-commitment period management fees. Those are five of the scariest words you can hear on examination. And look, the exam staff and enforcement have made this a huge priority the past few years, and you've seen a lot of enforcement actions in this space, and you're seeing just deeper and deeper and deeper dives on exams. I'm seeing them every day on exams. And you know, it started as sort of only on the disposition side, right? Like, so you know, just to take a step back, folks maybe aren't familiar, right, during the commitment period in a closed-end fund, generally the fee is on committed capital. After the investment period, it's generally on invested capital to a variety of different ways of how to define that. And then invested capital is usually adjusted based on write-downs, write-off, dispositions, all sorts of different things. And so the initial push, which has been going on for a couple of years, it was on the reduction side, right? Like, when do you have to reduce invested capital, therefore reducing the investor base? And that has been a subject of many enforcement actions and is of intense focus on closed-end fund advisors. What you're seeing now is a move into how that invested base is created, right? And what expenses go in there, what other things go into it. You know, not pretty quiet, I think, on the enforcement front on that piece, but in terms of announced actions, but certainly intense focus on that during examinations and basically all things related to how you calculate post-commitment period manager fees. So there is, you know, no hotter issue right now on examinations in for closed-end private fund advisors.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chris, for helping to frame that. Christine, anything to add to that or any other issues that you're seeing really from kind of private fund advisors or other folks as it relates to fees and expenses?
Absolutely. I think one thing to add is just, I agree with Chris, a deep dive is what exam staff is doing into fund documents that disclose how the management fee is calculated, what is an impaired investment, when does that need to be removed from the fee calculations. And so I think we're continuing to see that. Another area where we're seeing some pressure is on services and what types of services might an advisor be providing in-house that it could outsource, but it's providing those in-house, it's carving that out of the management fee, it's charging the fund separately for that, and maybe that is or is not disclosed in the offering documents. That's something the exam staff is going to look at. And then if the advisor is using its in-house staff to provide services to the fund that it could otherwise outsource, what type of benchmarking is being done on that? And we know that in the registered fund space, this is a well-oiled machine in terms of benchmarking and what the standard rates are for certain types of services, but I think it's less so in the private fund space. And as more managers start to build out their internal teams to be able to facilitate these services, I think they need to think a little bit more about how are we supporting the fees that we're charging and how are we distinguishing that from the things we're supposed to do as an investment manager already per our fiduciary duty. So as we know with the outsourcing proposal, the SEC is very focused on that, wanting to know more about, well, what does the management fee cover? So I think being a little bit more articulate and precise about what does the management fee cover, what does it not cover, and for other services that are being provided in-house, how are we supporting those calculations?
Yeah, I love the way you framed that, especially at the end too, in kind of being precise, being articulate in the way that you describe it. Because I think, right, I mean, like generally speaking, one of the nice parts about being in the advisor space versus say the broker-dealer space where things can be a little bit more prescriptive at times is that if you provide the proper disclosures and everybody understands kind of what it is that you're going to do and the fees that you're going to charge, I'm not going to say it's a universal panacea, but it certainly puts you in a much better position. And I think part of the issue to your point about mutual fund advisors having already gone through this quite a bit because of the investment company space being, again, a little bit more prescriptive and forcing them to be specific about doing those benchmarking surveys and identifying what those costs would look like. It just hasn't been the case on the private fund advisor side. And so maybe now it's starting to creep up a little bit. Chris, anything to add to that? Any other areas that you think might be worth mentioning for folks that you're seeing either during examinations or questions you're getting from clients, regulatory and compliance issues?
Yeah, I think recycling has become a pretty hot topic on examinations. And so, you know, this is where firms have the ability to, you know, either use cash that was use capital that was called for fees and expenses, or use capital that was realized within a certain period of time and redeploy that capital. So basically you can turn like a $1 billion fund into a $1.2 billion fund or something like that, where you can basically reuse capital to effectively increase the size of your fund. Investors, you know, my experience actually really like this because you basically pay manager fees on committed capital, but you get to deploy more capital. But I think it's popular with it, very popular with investors. I think that where exams have been digging in on is on authority, right? Do you follow all the little mechanics of it to make sure that, you know, it complies with the representation that you made in the LPA? And then, you know, just if there's any sort of risks associated with the recycling, or, you know, sometimes this ties in with the post-commitment period manager fee. Sometimes there can be so much recycling that the post-commitment period manager fee is actually larger because you invested so much capital. Again, probably like a good thing from the perspective of a lot of investors. But was that described adequately to investors? And so just a lot of digging in. I think we're to some degree on kind of the early phase of this from the exam staff in terms of how they're thinking about recycling, but seeing a lot of questions and a lot of deep dives on recycling mechanisms. Even if it doesn't result in a deficiency, we're just seeing a lot of questions.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I'm glad that you provided a little bit of background on kind of what recycling is. Again, I think a lot of our private fund compliance folks would certainly understand that. But yeah, the concept there is certainly, and some of the advice that you articulate around it is certainly well received. A couple final items in our compliance grab bag today. A couple of old stalwarts, I think, here on in the compliance world. But let's talk about insider trading in MNPI, because, you know, this, I feel like it's a little bit of a fashion to, like, and sometimes insider trading is very in vogue and sometimes it's not as much, right? But I think we're seeing a little bit of a comeback now. And maybe Christine, I'll start with you. What are you seeing there? And then I will think we'll close up shop by talking a little bit about form ADVs and regulatory filings. But we'll stay on insider trading for now.
Well, on MNPI, I have a good twist for you to keep this topic fresh. And that twist is the use of AI in expert network platforms. So the use of AI to help summarize calls with experts, to help create, maybe not have a transcript of that call, but instead have a short summary of what was said in that meeting, and how accurate is it? And does the advisor have to record keep something like that if it is actually not maintained on the advisor systems, but on the platform of the expert network, for example? So this parallels a lot of the concepts we opened up the podcast with, talking about AI for note-taking purposes. But the twist is, okay, note-taking purposes on an expert network platform, and what does that mean in the MNPI context? So maybe that helps keep the topic a little bit fresh.
So fresh, so clean. I love that. That's awesome. Chris, any thoughts on MNPI and insider trading?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real challenge, because of the series of enforcement actions we've seen, particularly over the past couple of years, is when firms move into new lines of business. And so you have a hedge fund arm, and you have a credit arm, and you have a private equity arm. And what kind of policies you have in place to prevent MNPI from, you know, do you have a single restricted list, or do you have multiple restricted lists, and then have barriers between them, right? Those are some like really fundamental questions that people have to ask themselves, that I think everyone should have been asking themselves those questions. But I think just, you know, the sort of, you know, litany of enforcement action sort of exactly on that point, where there wasn't any allegation of like actual insider trading, right? No one ever, you know, a lot of these enforcement actions, no one ever claimed that someone traded on material non-public information. It's purely on the 204A policies and procedures, right? Not even the code of ethics. This is the naked 204A section provision. And seeing all those enforcement actions brought on it, I think has made people really think about their lines of business and like, what are we doing with MNPI and making sure that we're containing it? You know, again, if you're going to use multiple restricted lists, and who's on these investment committees, and what access do they have, and when do they recuse themselves, and on, it just leads to so many different questions and issues that I think people are taking very, very seriously now because of all the enforcement actions.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that's great advice, and definitely something that people are going to want to pay attention to. This has been an incredible discussion. I got one final question for you. It's a little bit of a look forward, but, you know, we're in the midst of you know, I don't know, the busiest time of year, the regulatory filing season is upon us. And so as folks are, as you're thinking about Form ADBs and annual updates, any thoughts, considerations that folks should be thinking about, whether that's on disclosures or any of the other topics that we've talked about today? And maybe Chris, I'll pick on you this time to start.
Yeah, I think when there are issues that are emerging during exams, right, there are sort of issues that have not been highly publicized. A great way to get ahead of that is to put risk factors addressing those issues in your ADB, right? It's not going to be perfect. You still may get a deficiency if you have this issue, but it will really help you, you know, to point to something if the issue comes up on exam. So I think really making sure your risk factors reflect the very latest thinking from what exam staff is looking at and the risks that they are citing on examinations is incredibly important. And that is a very important use of your time during this otherwise very crazy time that I know there's so much going on, but don't lose sight of those risk factors in your brochure and make sure they reflect sort of the latest risks that are out there.
That is a great suggestion. My takeaway for ADB season might be a little bit less cerebral, but just thinking about what types of disclosures do we need to add? Do we need to add something on our use of AI? Do we need to add something if we're moving into a new asset class like crypto? And do we need to add something on the change of presidential administration and how that could impact the strategy? But also, this is more of a cleanup item, but just thinking about, do we need to delete COVID-19 disclosure and smooth that over into a general health risk disclosure? Do we need to smooth over the geopolitical risk section and just make that a little bit more in a way that we don't have to keep updating it and adding new countries every time, just to make those things a little bit less burdensome? And then, of course, all of the rules that have gone away due to litigation, right? If you're still talking about the private fund advisor rule, we need to change that, the dealer rule, right? So just taking an inventory of some of those things.
I think that is exceptional advice, Christine. You're exactly right. Sometimes people think, oh, well, I've drafted this ADV. I made sure to put all of the right disclosures in it. And you got to remember, it's a living, breathing document. It's a current snapshot of your firm as it stands right now. And if these things, like the private fund advisor rules, the DOL fiduciary rule and other stuff, if they're no longer in play, then you need, rightfully so, to make sure to tailor those disclosures appropriately.
Christine, right. Dodd-Frank wasn't passed recently.
Right.
Right. You still see some of that.
Yeah.
It's been a while. Recently.
We're okay. It's been a minute. Christine, this has been an absolutely exceptional conversation. And thank you both so much for coming on the show today and sharing your insights with us as we covered a wide swath of topics during our compliance grab bag. We are officially now post Super Bowl and before March Madness and St. Patrick's Day. So one quick final question. Again, I promise this will be an easy one. No compliance legal stuff. What's maybe one book that you're reading or one TV show or a new movie you've seen that you really like that you would commend others to dig in on?
I'll start and I would say Three Body Problem.
Okay. All right. Very good. Mr. Mulligan.
Just a very lame answer. Severance. I think everyone in the world is watching that show and talking about it. And I don't mind being, you know, sort of basic on that point, because it is a fantastic show that I love. And it's sort of fun to have one of these shows that everyone's watching and talking about again and trying to figure out what's happening. So I'm enjoying Severance.
Hey, there's a reason why sometimes stereotypes around what's a good show exists, right? If it's good, it's good. But thank you.
No spoilers.
Yeah, right. Thank you both again so much for coming on the show. Really a wonderful conversation with you both. And look forward to having you both back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The final part of today's show features another segment of What's On My Mind. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents a tip of the cap to all those editorial artists from years past, and will often include a unique perspective or nuanced take and highlight how it relates to the investment management industry and our securities compliance family. In today's What's On My Mind, Recently, Commissioner Hester Peirce penned a statement providing a brief overview of the SEC Crypto Task Force and what it's working on across the commission's policy divisions. I found the statement to be particularly informative and insightful on the road ahead for digital assets and cryptocurrencies, and so I thought I would share with you a few of those thoughts and comments from Commissioner Peirce now. At the top, I found it interesting that Commissioner Peirce went out of her way to really discuss that, you know, one, it's going to take some time for the SEC and the industry more broadly to come out of the kind of mess that we're in right now with regard to cryptocurrencies and digital assets and provide a better framework for which we can operate in this space. She talked about continuing to want to have folks have the freedom to experiment and build interesting things, but that certainly the long-term solution here will not just be a haven for fraudsters and making sure that the SEC continues to enforce its rules that are designed to protect investors and foster the integrity of the marketplace. She also talked about how the task force is really working hard to help create a regulatory framework that both achieves the regulatory objectives, including that which I just mentioned, like protecting investors, but also preserves the industry's ability to offer products and services and to innovate and to do things that help make our financial markets as dynamic as they are. She also talked about how the SEC is working hard to process applications for exemptive relief, including related requests for no action letters and registration statements and other related items to that. Obviously, given the potential influx of these, she cautioned folks to afford the SEC a little bit of grace and time to get through all of that. She also talked about how the commitment of this task force is really to commit themselves to a better regulatory environment. And that does not necessarily mean that the SEC in any way is endorsing any particular crypto coin or token. And then she went through kind of a list of, you know, specific kind of to-dos, and again, focusing on particularly that she plans to collaborate with across the commission's policy and across the commission's policy divisions. And some of those different items that the task force is working on included the following things. So one, security status, right? So obviously that's a fundamental question. And the task force is working hard to examine different types of crypto assets and ultimately trying to resolve that question. She talked about her second item was scoping out, right? So the task force will work to help identify areas that fall outside of the commission's jurisdiction. And again, she continued to welcome the request from the industry for no action letters by which that presents them with particular circumstances and helps give the broader public a window into the staff's thinking. She talked about coin and token offerings, and that the task force is also thinking about the possibility of recommending commission action to provide temporary, prospective, and retroactive relief for coin or token offerings for which the issuing entity or some other entity willing to take responsibility provides certain specified information, keeps that information updated, and agrees not to contest the commission's jurisdiction in the event of a case alleging fraud in connection with the purchase and sale of that asset. This approach, as she articulates, would certainly help bridge a gap until a more permanent rule or legislation could be finalized, and would also be a pathway for existing tokens to find their way out of the fog of uncertainty, as she describes, that obscures kind of a feasible path forward and would certainly continue to encourage the provision of greater disclosure. Another thing the task force is looking at is registered offerings. So the task force will consider working with staff to recommend that the commission modify existing paths to registration, including Regulation A and crowdfunding, so that people that are interested, genuinely interested in registering token offerings, will have a viable path for doing so. The fifth item she mentioned in her list was a special purpose broker dealer, that the task force will explore possible updates to the special purpose broker dealer no action statement, which in its current form has not really been successful. And an initial change that she is looking to suggest is that the statement be expanded to cover broker dealers that custody crypto asset securities alongside crypto assets that are not securities, And working with the public to help identify other, you know, potential obstacles to registration. The sixth item she mentioned was custody solutions for investment advisors. So here, the task force would work with investment advisors to provide an appropriate regulatory framework within which advisors could safely, legally, and practically custody client assets themselves or with a third party. The seventh thing she mentioned was crypto lending and staking, meaning that the SEC could provide clarity about whether crypto lending and staking programs are covered by the securities laws, and if so, how. The task force plans to work to help address how such programs can be structured consistent with the law. The eighth thing that she mentioned was the crypto exchange traded products, specifically that the commission already is receiving SRO proposed rule changes to list new types of crypto exchange traded products. The task force will work with the staff to provide clear statements about the approach used when approving or disapproving these applications, and will also work with the commission in considering requests to modify certain features of existing exchange traded products, including to allow for staking and in-kind creations and redemptions. But before these changes can be operationalized, however, the commission may have to make some progress on custody and some of those other issues that we've talked about previously. The ninth thing that Commissioner Peirce mentioned was with regard to clearing agencies and transfer agents, specifically that the task force also plans to work on the intersection of crypto and clearing agency transfer agent rules, where the SEC would continue to work with market participants interested in tokenizing securities or otherwise using blockchain technology to modernize traditional financial markets. And finally, the last item on Commissioner Peirce's list was the item she described as cross-border sandbox, meaning that many crypto projects are international in scope, and the task force is already considering ways to facilitate cross-border experimentation on a limited scale and temporary timeframe, with the possibility of more permanent long-term approaches down the road. Finally, she certainly hopes and expects folks that are interested in engaging with the crypto task force to go ahead and do so. And you can submit emails and other comments with that subject line, crypto task force input, to crypto@sec.gov. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Christine Schleppergrell and Chris Mulligan, for coming on the show today and sharing their wonderful insights on our grab bag of regulatory and compliance issues. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance and Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Or go to ComplianceandContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.